Canto 2, Chapter 10. We're going to cover texts 14 through 24. So, quick summary, and then I'm going to ask you some questions, and then I'll continue. The chapter begins with Shukadeva Goswami speaking to Maharaj Parikshit, and he identifies the 10 topics that are found within Srimad Bhagavatam. He very quickly identifies what those 10 topics are and then states that of the 10, one of the 10 is, it's the resting place, the shelter, the source, the purpose behind the other 9. In this morning's verses, the phrase is used, like a king is followed behind by his subjects. So this one, number 10 of the 10 items of the Bhagavatam, is the lead and most important central topic, and the other 9 topics are in pursuance of the 10th. And that 10th is Ashraya, in the purport we heard Sva-Shraya-Shraya, Sva, that syllable Sva, refers to his own ashraya. Krishna is his own shelter. Krishna has no other shelter. Rather, all other things that are giving some shelter have him as their shelter. Like the demigods, they give shelter. Or the parents in the room here give shelter to their children. Those who give shelter have as their shelter one who has no other shelter. So that's the 10th topic, that's Krishna. He's the shelter of all other topics. He's the shelter of all other shelters. He's the cause of all other causes. And in short, that's what the chapter is about. So to expand that theme, Krishna is the cause of all causes, the shelter of all other shelters, the topic of all other topics. Shukadeva Goswami chooses to go down the path of describing how all other topics or all other entities or all other things come into being from that primal source. And he discusses, so now we're coming into the I'm going to ask you some questions part of this morning. He discusses there are 3 perspectives to look at any person. There are 3 perspectives to look at any person. There's the person himself, there's the body and senses of the person, and then there's the influences upon that person. The higher order of influences upon that person. And when you look at the person, you can look at that person in terms of the higher order of influences upon that person. And so these three terms are adi-atmic, adi-bhautic, and adi-daivic. Okay, so now it's participation time. What does adi-atmic mean?
The soul proper.
Adi-atmic. Okay. And adi-bhautic person, the adi-bhautic person means? Let's have some raising of hands. Yes?
Body and the senses,
which are comprised of material energy. Body and senses, comprised of material energy. And adi-daivic refers to?
The power of the demigods.
Okay, the power of the demigods. Is that what you were going to say? Power of the demigods. And what specific, a little more specific, what power of the demigods acts upon the adi-atmic and adi-bhautic portion of the person? The sensual power, the power of the senses to work. So there's the instrument, that's the sense, and there's the living entity over here, the soul proper. So the power of the senses to perceive, or the living, go the other way, from the living entity to use the sense organ. That's the adi-daivam, the power of the senses, connecting. Okay. Very good. So, now is there a fourth entity? What is the fourth entity that's described here by Shukadeva Goswami?
Everything is dependent on the Supreme Lord.
Okay. Everything. So, what's the term? Everything is dependent upon the Supreme Lord. The term that's used?
Sarvashraya.
That's from the purport. And what's the term that's in the verse? Go ahead, take a stab.
You said
adi-yagya. Very good. Adi-yagya. What does adi-yagya mean? Adi-yagya. What does yagya mean?
Sacrifice.
Adi-yagya. First sacrifice, that's a good guess. Adi-yagya means the Supreme Lord. Why does adi-yagya mean the Supreme Lord? If yagya means sacrifice. It's a very complicated question, so we better watch out. I would like you to try to respond. Yagya means sacrifice. Adi-yagya refers to the Supreme Lord. All sacrifices are meant for the Supreme Lord. That's right. That was easy, wasn't it? And therefore, he's adi-yagya. Now, let me asked you to consider, do you make sacrifices in the course of your daily life? All the time. Get up in the morning. Go to bed at night. Walk across the room. Eat your food. Drive your car. Go to work. You make sacrifices all the time. For whom do we make those sacrifices depends upon our consciousness. And so this is the divisions between material and spiritual consciousness. Recognizing adi-yagya or not, just making sacrifices. And if we don't make sacrifices for adi-yagya, What is the driving force behind those sacrifices? Sense gratification. So, whose senses are to be satisfied? Rishikesh. Rishikena, Rishikesha Sevanam, Bhakti Ruchate. But supposing someone doesn't want to do that. I know some people that don't want to do that. So, does that mean they don't make sacrifices? They definitely make sacrifices. For what do they make sacrifices? At least the plan is to get some sense gratification. And whenever I am getting some sense gratification, more or better, or both, sense gratification. That is, trying to enjoy the senses separately from Rishikesh or Adiyagya. So that's illusory. It's sacrifice in illusion. And how does all of that come into play? Sacrifice in illusion, or the sacrifice unto Adiyagya or Vishnu. So there's a couple of verses. This is just review still. The Supreme Lord recognizes that a portion of the living entities, who are all from Him, He's the Father. So He's certainly aware of how His children, the living entities, the expansions of His marginal potency, are disposed. Some want to enjoy in relation to Him. Some have an attitude and don't want to enjoy in relation to Him. And so He makes this very sophisticated arrangement through His energies to provide that romper room, that place where they can go and have their toys and try to enjoy independent from Him. So we discussed He, the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world, lies down in the sum total of the material elements in the Mahatattva in His expanded form as Mahavishnu. And He lies down on the causal ocean. From the pores of His body come these seeds in their subtle state, and forming around the seeds are the ingredients. They generate the universes, and then from each of those universes He expands as Garbhadakshai Vishnu, and from His navel, it's a really cool way to do it, from His navel He generates a lotus stem and a flower on top, and pow, there's Brahma on top of that stem, on top of the lotus. And He gives Brahma everything He needs to do to create the details of that universe. And Brahma goes to work and creates. Mention is made that just as the Lord is personal, the water that comes from His body is also personal and transcendental like Him. Therefore, the water is called Nara, and He is called Narayana. Then, this two more verses. One should definitely know that all material ingredients, activities, time, and modes, Dravya Karma, Kalas, Swabhava Jiva, everything that makes up this universe, like creation, cosmic manifestation, exists because he exists. And if he desired them to not exist, they would not exist, of course. As we mentioned, he doesn't have such a desire, but we should know that their existence is dependent upon his desiring them to exist. And now, how does that work? How, by his desiring them to exist, that statement is now unpacked. Unpacked, like, you know, take a ball of cotton and pull it apart and pull it apart and pull it apart and pull it apart and hold up this strand and that strand and this strand, and then he's going to put it back together again and pack it up again. So he desires them to exist, and so they exist. That's called creation. And he doesn't care for them to exist anymore, and so they wound back up. They wind back up in an unmanifest state, all the ingredients, all undifferentiated. And the living entities also, because there's the material energy, and then there's the marginal living entity, which is also his energy. And they're again resting within his abdomen. That's another meaning of Narayana, the shelter of all naras, of all beings. In that one sentence, that one verse, all things come into being, all things are wound up. Creation and annihilation in one verse. That is, it's all resting upon his Ichha Shakti, his desire, his will. Now, the unpacking part. Starting with this morning's verse, text 14. Just hear from me, Shukadev is speaking, how the potency of his lordship divides one into three, called Adidaivam, Adiatmam, and Adibhutam, in the manner mentioned above. So this is how this one becomes three manifests. So the three again, just so we're really clear what our topic is, Adidaivam. Prabhupada calls this the controlling entities. Adiatmam, the controlled entities. These are both persons. And Adibhautam is the material bodies, so the mind and senses, matter. These three are necessary. It's worth repeating it again. The three are interdependent, and the fourth is independent. Krishna is independent. And all others, including the demigods, including the living entities, including matter, two things. They're interdependent to work, and they're dependent upon the independent. If we can understand that principle, the rest is just interesting and to a degree technical. Now, so that's the setup. Now here comes the first bhavati from the sky. Here's the Sanskrit. Anta sharira akash. Sharira means body. Anta sharira, within the body of Mahapurusha, akash. Akash means sky. From the sky, situated within the transcendental body of the manifesting Mahavishnu. So there's, we already have Mahavishnu has been described. He's lying on the causal ocean within the Mahatattva. Why is he there? Because living entities are desiring enjoyment independent from him. So he's facilitating that. And then there's this sky within his body. Now within his body is everything. Just like Mother Jasoda, when she looked inside Krishna's mouth, what did she see? She saw everything. Could you imagine? I mean, could you imagine seeing everything, what to speak of inside someone's mouth? Just imagine seeing everything. You can't imagine that, because it's a short circuit your brain. You can't see everything. But Mother Jasoda saw. And Mahavishnu also has everything. So within his body, everything is there. And part of that everything is this Akash. Antashirira Akasha. Purushasya. Vicheshtataha. Vicheshtataha means desiring or willing. Let some things start to come out. Okay, so things start to come out. Why does he want those things to fulfill the desire of the living entity? It's a reciprocation. It's a loving gesture from the Lord towards the living entities who are rebellious. I don't want to be around you. Go out of existence. I'm out of here. Okay, here's some illusion. You can try to enjoy apart from me. And so he manifests. Four things are mentioned. Oja. Oja means sensory power. Saha means mental power, mental strength, mental force. Oja, saha, balam, means bodily strength. And also the fourth thing, prano, mahan, asu. Prana we know, vital force. Prana mahan is, Prabhupada is translated as the sum total of vital force. Asahu is everyone's. So, Mahan Asahu, the total life force of all living entities. Now, question. Is prana the same thing as the living entity? No. Prana is something material. It's subtle material, but it's material, not the living entity. So it's another material thing. So, mental strength. Mental strength isn't going to do anything unless the connection between the mental strength and the sense organ, excuse me, Oja, the energy of the senses. So we need adidaivam. This is the point. It's like an ingredient. There's the senses, there's the sense strength, but you have to have a connector. That's adidaivam. It empowers this to connect with that. And if the adidaivam says no, or even worse, if the adidaivam isn't there yet, nothing happens, because you need, they're interdependent, you need them. Okay, so we're still at, it's an ingredient manifesting stage. Sense power, mental strength. Bodily strength. All of these things are jagye, they're generated or manifested. How are they manifested? You change it to her. Okay, let it happen. Just by willing. And bhavati. Boom, 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 boom. They're manifested. The parts of the machine. Now, the assembling of the parts of the machine comes next. It's very, very sequential. Next. Now, this verse is describing another principle. It was actually mentioned. Naradevam Ivanugaha. Anuga. Like we're Rupa Anugas. They're followers of Rupa Goswami. So, the followers, Naradevam Ivanugaha. Iva means like the followers of a king follow behind the king, or the king is followed by his followers, like that. So also, when the total material energy is set in motion, then all living entities move. And conversely, this is the winding up of the creation. When the total energy stops endeavoring, all living entities stop. Sensual activities, the living entities and the senses and the sensual power and mental strength, and it just goes back into the body of the Lord. So the message here is we're dependent. We may have, you know, this I want to enjoy thing happening. But if it's not okay, you can enjoy, and it doesn't happen. Not only it doesn't happen, but we go into this unmanifest state. So the manifestation is an act of will or sanction of the Supreme Lord, vichesthitaha. He permits, or in the language of Bhagavad Gita, anumanta, upadrashta, and anumanta. 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the function of Supersoul is he sees, upadrashta, and he permits, anumanta. Following his manta, we can then do. All right. And then it can happen. And if he doesn't say all right, it can't happen. Now we can be like little children stamping our feet saying, I want, I want, I want, I want, I want. And if he doesn't say okay, it doesn't happen. Just like that. Now another thought I had this morning when reading this. We are like little children in the sense that how much do little children appreciate all the efforts that mother and father go through to provide stuff, like home and food and cooking the food and clothing and arrangements for school and, you know, cleaning up and it just like happens and they take it for granted, generally. It's quite common. And you can't so much blame because they're children. And we're like children. There's all this arrangement going on and, you know, we just take it for granted. So what the Bhagavatam is helping those that don't want to just take things for granted to understand what a complicated arrangement is being made so our desires to enjoy can be provided for and our necessity, what we consider necessities. And the soul doesn't have any of these necessities. But we think they're necessities. It's like, you know, some kids see other kids with little toys or Game Boys or something, so I've got to have one and I can't live without one. I'll die if I don't have one. I want to enjoy. So, it's called marketing. You get all the kids wanting to have a Harry Potter book, so you got to go get your kids a Harry Potter book because all the other kids have a Harry Potter book and they're all talking about it. And so, you know, I want to have one too. It's called marketing. So, how do all these things come into being? The reason for going through all this, connecting with the discussion at the end of yesterday evening's class, is so we can have some greater appreciation of how the Supreme Lord is making all this arrangement. No, he knows fully well it's just illusion. It's all this temporary manifestation of his inferior energy for us to try to enjoy. Let us appreciate what he's doing. And in that gratitude or appreciation, use it in the proper way. Because these mentioned already is there's two functions. One is to give us that opportunity to try to enjoy independently for him, which can't happen because we're jumping up and down, stamping our foot, saying, I want. So the other side is what the real intention of the Lord is through creation is to reform our mistakes and bad character, to come to the position of not requiring this illusion anymore, so that our spiritual identities can be fully restored. That's the purpose. We can have deeper sense of gratitude for the Supreme Lord making all the arrangements, because we can't do it on our own. The adiatmic influence can't do it, even if the other two are there. Even if the senses are there and the sanction is there. The power of the senses are connected to the sense by the demigod hookup. By the demigods making that arrangement. So now the point is, because the living entities, this is the summary statement, because the living entities desire enjoyment, the Lord expands this total material energy, and he, in this total material energy position, desires things so that the living entities can desire things and can facilitate them. Here's how, what Prabhupada writes in the purport. No one has independent existence, just as no electric lamp has independent effulgence. Where does the lamp get its illuminating capacity? It gets the illuminating capacity from the powerhouse. And where does the powerhouse get its capacity? From the reservoirs of water. If it's turbine, water-driven electricity. And where does the reservoir of water get its power? From the clouds. Where does the clouds get its power? From the sun. Where does the sun get its power? This is just from the purport, from the creation itself. Where does the creation itself derive its power? From the sanction of the Supreme Lord. And so, ultimately, the light bulb here is dependent upon the sanction of the Supreme Lord. So, and without the light, either the light of the sun or some transformed manifestation of the sun's energy, these eyes can't see. We can't see other things, nor can we see ourselves. What to speak of even the things to see, and the light by which to see, and the instrument to see, the eye. We're dependent. Like the question, how do we think of ourselves as, how do we properly understand ourselves as dependent? Just contemplate through the assistance of the scripture. So what's the message? The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the cause of all causes. We cannot do anything without His sanction. We're fully dependent. And this is elaborating on that in some very interesting detail. Okay, so now we have these four things. We have the power of the senses, the power of the mind, sensual, the bodily strength. We have the totality of living force. So this living force, prana, being agitated by the virat purusha. What happened? We got this virat purusha thing happening, and before it was Mahavishnu. And all of a sudden, it's talking about virat purusha. So what's going on here? So what is virat purusha? What's the relationship of virat purusha to the Purusha avatars? Answer, the Virat Purusha is a manifestation, a temporary manifestation for the purpose of creation to manifest further downstream components of the material creation. So, this Virat Purusha, it's the form of the universe, it's the Lord's form of the universe. Even before the universe, as we see it, manifests. So, you know, we can't see all of the universe, but whatever part of the universe we can see, that's the byproduct of the Virat Purusha, who's the expanded form of the Lord of the universe. And it's temporary. Therefore, because it's temporary, it's described as an illusory form. Because now you see it, now you don't. The Lord's form, Mahavishnu, isn't now you see it, now you don't. Or Narayana, or the spiritual forms of the Lord. They're not temporary. But this Virat Purusha is. So he manifests this form to, once again, further the process of creation to manifest different parts of creation and the functioning of creation itself. Here's how it works. The living force, being agitated by the Virat Purusha, generated hunger and thirst. And when capital H, he, that's Virat Purusha, desire to drink and eat, the mouth opened. Prabhupada explains, the desires for all kinds of sense perception and sense organs exist in the Supreme. You with me? It's very important to understand what's being described here. And thus, they, that's sense perceptions and the workings of the sense organs, take place in the individual persons. Stated again, slightly differently. This desire is the nature of the Supreme Living Being, the Absolute Truth, because He has the sum total of all mouths. The individual living entities have mouths. What does that mean? That Virat Purusha is the form of the universe. And within the universe, there's arms and legs and mouths and hands and so many, just like it's described. Sahasra Shirsha Purusha, Sahasraksha, Sahasrapat. This is, you know, what the mundane scholars call imagination. imagination of the Vedas. Imagine thousands of hands and thousands of mouths, and unlimited numbers of faces and legs. And what's that? It's Devarat Purusha. And from that totality of mouths, there's the, it's providing the living entity the capacity to fulfill his desire, to open his mouth and to enjoy the senses that are out there, but, you know, not connected to that living entity who wants to enjoy yet. So the Virat Purusha, desiring to enjoy, is to facilitate the living entity's desire to enjoy. See it the other way around. When that stops, the whole show comes to an end. Living entities are, show's over. Everything is withdrawn and back into the body of Mahavishnu. Show's over. And then, now Mahavishnu desires, okay, let the living entities enjoy again. And then the universes come out, and the Virat Purusha, and as happens with mouths, so happens with all the other senses. This is, if we can understand this one, we got the whole pattern, as it happens again and again with each of the senses. From the mouth, text 18, the palate becomes manifested, and thereupon the tongue was also generated. After this, all the different tastes came into existence so that the tongue can relish them. It's like a domino effect. And the first domino to move is Mahavishnu. And then next is Virat, because that's to facilitate this wish of Mahapurusha or Mahavishnu to reciprocate with the living entities who are rebellious towards him. And then the mouth of Virat Purusha opens, and then the mouth of the living entity, that sense. Now we're speaking, again, we're speaking of the subtle sense, not, you know, necessarily like this thing that you, that we all have in the front of our face, but, you know, the subtle sense. Here's what Prabhupada writes in the purport. This gradual process of evolution suggests the explanation of the controlling deities. Which of the three terms is the controlling deities? Adidaiva, right. Because Varuna is the controlling deity of all relishable juices. Now, what's Varuna in charge of? The oceans. And through water, through liquid, one can appreciate taste. You know, something is just totally dry, it's tasteless. When you add moisture to it, like even in your mouth, and the taste can come out, or soak it first, and so you take out all the water, no taste. So Varuna's the demigod in charge of tastes. Therefore, the mouth becomes the resting place for the tongue, which tastes all different juices, of which the controlling deity is Varuna. This suggests, therefore, that Varuna was also generated along with the development of the tongue. Okay, what's going on here? Where does Varuna come from? From when we look at, there's different ways of saying, but the way that this is describing is from the universal form of the Lord. On the body of the universal form, within the body of the universal form of the Lord, are the various devas. Yes, that's described. When Arjuna saw the universal form, he saw all the devas. So they're there. And when the universal form desires to taste Varuna, whoop, there he is. He takes form. He's there in this universal form, in this, you can say, dormant state, in the unmanifest state, and because the Lord desires to enjoy, Varuna is there to serve him. And he makes this arrangement, and also it's to facilitate the living entity's desire to enjoy, because that's why the Lord desires to enjoy tastes of this temporary creation. So Varuna appears, the tongue appears, and the objects of the tongue, the juices. 1, 2, 3. Now we have this, so it's adi daivik, adi bhautik, and adi atmik, all coordinated by adi yagya, or earlier in the language of this second canto is yagyapati, same idea. So, Prabhupada writes, the tongue and the palate, being instrumental, are called adibhutam, or forms of matter. So now he's introducing this other term, instrumental. The instrument, or the instrument of sense power. You have the sense power, but if the instrument's broken, you have power of locomotion, but if your legs are broken or missing, you need some instruments. So they're forms of matter, the legs or the tongue, it's forms of matter. It's adibhutam. But the functioning deity, who is a living entity, is adidaiva, whereas the person undergoing the function is adiatma. Thus, the three categories are explained as to their birth after the opening of the mouth of the Virat Purusha. Sequential. Dominoes. Boom, 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 boom. The four principles mentioned in this verse serve to explain the three main functions, namely adiatma, adidaiva, and adibhutam, as explained before. So there's, in short, summary, there's functions of the tiny living entity that are facilitated by these three, all of which are under the order of one. And then you get more than the sense of taste to the tongue and palate and the objects that are being tasted. You get the whole living entity with all of his senses. So next, so we can follow the sequence one more time. When the Supreme, this is the Virat Purusha, desired to speak, guess what happened? Speeches were vibrated from the mouth. So the mouth was manifested for taste, and now it's speech. These two functions, tasting and vibrating, they're the first ones. And they're the ones that we need to control most, because then the other senses can be controlled. That's our teaching. Takshi Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Grayam Indriyai Sevan Mukihi Jiva Dao Svayameva Svaratyada. In that verse by Rupa Goswami, he teaches, if you can control the tongue, you can control all other senses, although they're all very difficult to control. They're difficult to control because we don't really want to control them. We want them. Control is like punishment, and enjoyment is let them go. And I can be enjoying. That's the material, this fruitive desire. Uttaya. It's very powerful. So, when the Supreme desired to speak, speeches were vibrated from the mouth. Then, the controlling deity, fire, capital F, was generated from the mouth. That's Agni. But when he was lying in the water, all these functions remained suspended. It's just reminding us that Mahavishnu, lying down in the causal ocean, none of this was happening in the dormant state, but then things started to happen when he desired to make things manifest for the living entities who desire to. So it's when they're in the body of Mahavishnu, it's not like they don't have desires, but by his arrangement, those desires are temporarily suspended. The time factor is not active. But then he recognizes living entities' desire to enjoy, so he manifests those living entities from his body. And the time energy and, you know, all the ingredients and the whole thing, the whole show gets going. Listen carefully. Purport. The peculiarity of the gradual development of the different senses is simultaneously supported by their controlling deities. The interdependence idea. It is to be understood, therefore, that the activities of the sense organs are controlled by the will of the Supreme. How do we think of ourselves as dependent? We just heard it. We have sense organs. They don't work unless there's the arrangement for them to work. And that arrangement, the divam arrangement, is sanctioned by the Supreme. We're dependent. The senses are, so to speak, offering a license for conditioned souls who are to use them properly under the control of the controlling deity deputed by the Supreme Lord. One who violates such controlling regulations has to be punished by degradation to a lower status. Okay, so we desire to enjoy. Virat Purusha, Mahavishnu, Virat Purusha, the manifesting of these things. And now there's operating procedures. If we say, hey, I don't care for operating procedures, I'm an outlaw. I'm going to do what I like, according to my idea. Huh. Heck with these guys that gave me all this stuff. I'm just going to do what I like. Watch me. You violate the regulating principles, and what Prabhupada describes in the rest of the purport is, then one is provided a life form that is suitable to that unrestricted lifestyle. Like he gives the example of taste. So the human form is given a particular type of food for the palate, and if we violate that restriction or principle, then we're given another life form that's for that unrestricted eating. Become an animal that eats unrestrictedly. Hey, wait a minute, I didn't want that. Oh, yes, you did, because when your desire to enjoy was with regulation, you didn't like the regulation, but you wanted this unrestricted, and so you take the unrestricted eating and become a hog. Oh, if only I had known. Well, now we know. So there's the point here is this is another Adi Yajna principle. With the Adi Yajna principle, there's some yajna unto Vishnu that's to be performed, as Krishna says in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Along with creation, I send forth generations of Adiatma and Adidaiva, generations of men and demigods, and with them, yajna, and said, be happy by performance of yajna. And the converse is, you ignore yajna, and there's something else that you'll experience. Another life form where there's no sense of yajna. If that's what you want. That's not the order of preference. In the order of preference with yajna, it prepares us to return to get out of the independent enjoyment from the Supreme mentality and to become regulated by the Supreme, by, that is, satisfying the senses of the Supreme. But there's this interim phase. Like people ask the question sometimes, why, if the real principle of religion is just surrender to Krishna, why all these other things? And the answer is, for the very reason that we've come to the material world. We don't want to surrender to Krishna. We want to enjoy apart from Krishna. So all these other things are there to regulate that enjoy apart from Krishna mentality. In different gradations of that. Goodness, passion, ignorance. The real thing is transcendence. But some people, most people, are not prepared for that. And so many codes within the Vedas. Yeah, but those codes within the Vedas bewilder people. They think that's what it's all about. Oh my goodness. Thank you very much. So, again, when we receive the senses, it's like having a gun or something. You gotta have a license for the gun. Because it can do things in the proper way, but it can also be very detrimental and harmful. So you gotta have a license. And you break the license, the gun's taken away. This human form of sense capacity, mental strength, and so forth, you violate the license. You're in jail. The thing is taken away and into a lower species of life. So Prabhupada concludes, an irresponsible life of indiscrimination is risky, and that is the declaration of all scriptures. We're almost done with this morning's series of verses. So we just went through the mouth that has these two functions of tasting and vibrating. Next comes the nose. Thereafter, when the Supreme Purusha desired to smell odors, the nostrils and respiration were generated, the nasal instrument and odors came into existence, and the controlling deity of air, carrying smell, also became manifested. Well, a whole bunch of things happened just from Virat Purusha desiring to smell. So the instrument of smelling, air, which is necessary, the power of respiration, the odors, the object of smelling, and the controlling deity. Prabhupada writes, the nasal instrument plus odor plus the controlling deity, air. You have to have a controlling deity, and that's Vayu. Smelling, etc., all became manifested simultaneously when the Lord desired to smell. Here's the principle restated. The Vedic mantras confirm this statement in the Upanishads statement that everything is first desired by the Supreme before the subordinate living entity can act upon it. The Lord desired, and so it was. The living entity, so here it is explained again. The living entity can see only when the Lord sees. The living entity can smell only when the Lord smells, and so on. Here's the idea. The idea is that the living entity cannot do anything independently. That's the message. And that's how the system is set up, so that's the case always, in every circumstance. This independence of thinking, I'm independent, I'm going to do what I want, is thereby, even that is dependent by the grace of the Lord. But the thinking can be given shape by the grace of the Lord only, and therefore, the common saying is that man proposes and God disposes. The whole explanation is on the subject of the absolute dependence of the living entities and the absolute independence of the Supreme Lord. That one sentence is the summation of this chapter. And then there's details following that statement. Adiyagya is independent. Adidaiva, Adibhuta, and Adibhautak, dependent and interdependent. And the whole system comes about by his independent arrangement. And when his independent arrangement is withdrawn, the whole thing folds up. Note, I'll say it again, the living entities still have desire to enjoy. But when the game's over, it's over. It's over. Still I want to enjoy. I can't even pretend. I can't even be an illusion. Unless the Lord allows that to happen. So the reformation of the living entity is to understand that principle. We are dependent. We're not independent. Get it through our thick skull, as they say. Yeah, we're not independent. Now let's see, how do I want to enjoy? It's like, boom, boom. Because we're so conditioned. Last verse for this morning. Thus, when everything existed in darkness, the Lord desired to see himself and all that was created. Thus, the eyes, illuminating Sun God, the power of vision, and the object of sight, Bhavati, it all became manifested. So, what's there in the beginning of the universe when Brahma is there tottering on top of this lotus flower that has this really long, so the stem is so long you can't even find the end of it. Whoa. It's all darkness in all directions. He can't see, and there's not even any living entities to see along with him to not see. So the Virat Purusha, knowing that the living entities desire to see, he desires to see. And when he desires to see, the instrument of seeing, the eyes, because he's the repository, he has a big warehouse of eyes and mouths and noses of all different shapes, and living entity desires to see is fulfilled by the eyes, the controlling power of the sun, the power of vision. Remember, Oja, the sensory power, becomes manifest. And the object of sight. The night is the real feature of the universe, for at night one cannot see anything, including oneself. The Lord, out of his causeless mercy, first desired to see himself, and all of the creation as well. And thus, the sun became manifest, the power of vision for all living entities became possible, the objects of vision became manifested. This means that the whole phenomenal world became visible after the creation of the sun. Very interesting. Big Bang cosmology doesn't fit with Vedic conception of things. in one sense. Like this, that point that I mentioned last night. Is there any, when Prabhupada was asked, is there anything like Big Bang cosmology connected to the Vedic model of creation? So, as the universes come, now that we're speaking of what's happening inside one universe. So the sun is manifest. Is the sun eternal? Modern science says, and the Vedas concur, when at the time of cosmic annihilation, from the Vedic perspective, the sun, it's not like it burns out, it runs out of gas or something, but it's withdrawn. And it comes into being by the will of the Lord, to facilitate his desire to see. Which is to facilitate the desire of living entity to see, which can't happen without the sun. And so many other things that downstream, you know, life is sustained by the energy of the sun. So the Lord is not whimsical. He doesn't create something that then just fizzles. It sustains by the energy of the sun. And as he manifests things that require the sun's energy, the sun is, continues to shine until that point when it's his desire. Let's withdraw this thing. And it happens. And it has a sequence. It's very logical, very sensible arrangement. And then the arrangement is, one description of that arrangement is, when it's time for the cosmic annihilation, the elements are just manipulated differently. There's a withdrawal of water. There's drought. Everything becomes really dry. And then the fire. Everything becomes engulfed in fire. And then after everything becomes engulfed in fire, then again this cosmic deluge. Everything just gets dissolved. All that ash or just residual earthy element gets dissolved back in water. And then that water gets withdrawn. So the elements, this is the partial annihilation, and the cosmic annihilation happens by elements folding back upon one another. But all the planets that Brahma set up, the Lord has a plan whereby those planets that Brahma set up are dissolved like a tablet in water. He gives him the energy to create. He gives Lord Shiva the energy to destroy. And meanwhile, by his plan, everything is maintained. All according to the modes of nature and the karma of the living entities, he makes this plan. So the theme, once again, is we're dependent. And recognizing our dependence, we should offer our obeisances and our service to the personality of Godhead. That's the purport, or the purpose behind narrating all of this by Shukadeva Goswami. Any questions?
Compassion behind the material creation is the living entity's desire.
It's the Lord's desire. The Lord has compassion to do these two things. Allow the living entity the opportunity to explore trying to enjoy independent from him. And also to reform that mistake. But the compassion is the Lord's. The mistake is ours. Okay. Yes. Okay.
The first one, I'm not able to understand, probably trying to understand it in a material sense, but like the connection between Viraj Purusha and Lord Brahma, like Brahma is creating, he's creating all the material forms, and out here it seems like all the instruments of senses are coming.
Well, where is the answer is, where does Brahma get the, where's the warehouse that Brahma goes to get stuff, to do his creating? Yeah, and yes, that's correct. And the agency of Vishnu is this Virat. So you can, to make it really easy for yourself, you can say from Mahavishnu. Because he has unlimited energies and he's supplying those energies to Brahma. Or Garbhadaksha Vishnu, same. But then there's this, what's hard to understand is not just, is what Virat Rupa is. It's very difficult. Because it's a form of the Lord, but at the same time it's temporary. So that's where the difficulty lies. You could just skip it and just say from Lord Vishnu. But there's this form that when Mahavishnu is making these arrangements, there is this manifestation of the Virat Rupa. And Brahma is in part of the body of Virat Rupa, as Brahma comes from the body of Garbhadaksha Vishnu. It's not like one of these really crystal clear things. So try to nail it down further and you might just be hammering your head.
So where does this Virat Rupa exist? Where is the existence of Virat Rupa, even though temporary, when he manifests? And also when this purported says, like, he desired to see himself because everything was dark, but then, so the Lord's effulgence, so is Virat Rupa form?
It's a universal form, and it's of the universe. No, your question, first one was, where does he reside? He is the universe. He's the form of the Lord's form of the universe. It's something like a prototype before the universe manifests. Something like that. A subtle prototype of that which our eyes can see. We can look into the skies and look around us and see things. That's the byproduct of the prototype. And the prototype is Virat Rupa, and we don't have the eyes to see. So where does he exist? He exists in a dimension beyond which that which we have access to see or even think of. But he's the Lord's form of the universe. You know, I'll say it again. You keep it's the further one probes with this, it's not something that readily fits within the mind's construct. It's just, there are statements and we just have to accept those statements. The subtle form, or it's the material subtle form of the Lord. That's the form of the universe, which exists even before the universe exists, from which the universe is patterned. And on this universal form, the various demigods exist. And then they manifest when The universal form desires taste, or desires to see, or desires to smell. And although those things are statements within time, and yet the Lord is beyond time. And He's beyond material action, and yet these are material actions within time. So, it's this very curious, enigmatic space between the transcendental realm and the temporal realm. Very subtle, difficult to behold, difficult to conceive of, difficult to explain. So we can just refer to statements of the Vedas and carry on. What else?
I was thinking that the Lord goes through like so much to just fulfill our desires. And I mean, it's mind-boggling to think of the kind of love by which He goes through such an ordeal. And I was just thinking that not as a compassion, but I was just thinking that when we try to extend ourselves to somebody, and I find it very difficult to just like watch a person suffering, and I interfere maybe too soon. How to actually. I guess my question is that kind of love, like how. The
question that you had asked before was the balance between compassion or caring and detachment. That's.
Yeah. And so I question myself, and sometimes, like, I think, is it my controlling mentality or is it actually love? And sometimes it really seems like it's love, but then it's so hard to see the person go through the suffering.
Yeah.
But yet the Lord Himself makes so many arrangements to just. That must be so painful for the Lord.
Oh, so you're. Let's go back to the specific thing, because this is a very. The statement is broad. How do we see our own position? Short answer is mixed. Thus, we become, until that point, we become 100% pure in devotion. Our purposes or motivations are mixed. Certainly some compassion, certainly some controlling. And what do we do about that? The instruction is that we try to purify ourselves. We can try to purify ourselves through the medium of service, and how do we understand what service is pleasing to Krishna? And we can look at the example of Krishna, just as you're doing, and look at the example of the perfected souls representing Krishna. Look at Srila Prabhupada's example. And he went way out of his way to accommodate both things simultaneously, bringing souls to Krishna, but at the same time extending himself right in the midst of their impure business and making them so comfortable that they were, you know, they felt Prabhupada was one of them, but at the same time not one of them. Shamsundar gave as just one response, a thought on this. Shamsundar, Prabhupada disciple Shamsundar, who joined the Hare Krishna movement in San Francisco and 1968 or something like that, when the first Jagannath deities were found in an import shop and brought to Prabhupada as soon as, is this something from India? And Prabhupada immediately paid his obeisances and said, this is Lord Jagannath by his mercy, and he's come. And then he turned to Shyamasundara and said, can you carve big Lord Jagannath 3 feet tall and look like this? And he had never carved anything before, and Prabhupada gave him this can you do it look, and he did it. And they had their Jagannath Rath Yatra. And then Prabhupada wanted to spread Krishna consciousness in England, and so he asked 3 couples that were, you know, still with their diapers on, you know, they're just like really new in Krishna consciousness, go and start Krishna consciousness in England. And by Prabhupada's empowering them to do so, within a year's time, Prabhupada kept writing, should I come? Not just yet, Swamiji, we're still working on things. And what they wanted was to have such a grand entry for Srila Prabhupada. And he described when they first came from the airport, they went straight to John Lennon's estate. Like the most famous people in the world. Prabhupada came to stay in their home and to help them become Krishna conscious. And within a short time, they made a recording. Anyway, the beat of George Harrison orchestrated some recording that became a best-selling record in all of Europe for like the whole summer. It was a Hare Krishna song sung by the Beatles. So he was saying, this was all part of Prabhupada's magic, but Prabhupada's compassion was commensurate with his magic. And he gave this particular example. He said, I once had to go very, very ashamed of myself to go to Prabhupada and tell Prabhupada that I have to go to jail. And Prabhupada asked, what for? And he said, for dealing drugs. And Prabhupada said, oh, when I was in a grihastha, I was also dealing drugs. Meaning he was a pharmacist, and he sold drugs as a pharmacist. And so he was just, like Prabhupada just placed himself on the same platform as Shyamasundara. Just so he wouldn't feel so bad and feel, you know, as terrible as he was feeling. And he said, even Krishna, he appeared in a prison. Not so bad. And in a prison, you can chant all day long, very peacefully. He didn't describe what happened. Apparently, that somehow got changed. But that was Prabhupada just comforting him so much that all of his shame and his fear and his apprehension and anxiety just melted, just went away. Whatever was going to happen was going to be okay, because Prabhupada was not going to withdraw his compassion and his love for him. It didn't make him think, oh, drug dealing is okay. But it made him understand that Prabhupada's love was not going to be jeopardized by anything. So, nice example. How to care very deeply at the same time, play a supportive role and not interfere with the plans of the Supreme Lord or the implications of a living entity and not very nice parts of the material energy. And how that can be done is by purity and complete attachment to Krishna. Then we can be instruments that are effective. Yeah. It's like a physician that I know. His field is pain management. It's when people get to the point where nothing works, hundreds of things they've tried and nothing works, and they're just in this constant pain. And so his business is not to try one more time. His business is just to reduce the pain so they can manage, they can cope. So he has this really sophisticated, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars a piece of equipment where with some kind of invasive thing, he can see on this little, you know, some nerve is stretched over in the wrong place and he has to move it. So he prays very intently because even a slight mistake can bring enormous pain that could make the situation worse even after the procedure. So, like that, being an instrument for Krishna is when someone's in a painful situation to do whatever it is that we can do, praying very carefully, very, very attentively to Krishna to try to to allow our hands to be under his control. And whatever he arranges is, that's up to him. But we try our best with the best that we can offer. And it's up to Krishna. And that's where the detachment comes. It's that we're just instruments. And according to how Krishna wants to use us in a given circumstance. And our prayer should be to become better instruments. Not that Krishna gives us more, but we become better instruments. And Krishna will give us more. The capacity. The third one? Covered. Okay.
Like when somebody is really feeling bad about something or they're honest, it seems much easier to extend that. But when somebody is actually like manipulative but at the same time expressing something else externally, sometimes I get caught in that manipulation and I'm not sure, I make mistakes and
how to deal with, there's two parts. There's your part and then there's their part. Your part is what you can work on. And if another person is an unhappy or difficult or suffering condition, but they're at the same time either unwilling or in somewhat of denial of that condition or the cause of it. Not much, you know, one can incur two things with the other person. One can encourage them to be self-honest. And another is this balance between making an effort on their side and being interdependent or opening their heart to resources outside of themselves. Both. I can think of situations that I'm dealing with where individuals are in denial. And they're coping. In part, they're coping by denial. And it's very clear, because their coping mechanism is denial, that contradicting that denial is something that they're not going to be very receptive to. And so each situation has its own dynamic, and what's appropriate in one situation may be inappropriate in another situation, so there's no cookie cutter thing approach. But for sure, one principle that is very important, very, very, very important universally, is always extending as much as it's our capacity to do so, extending unconditional kindness and love upon that person, regardless of behaviors on the other side, the denials on the other side, the manifestations of, you know, things that are making themselves and others uncomfortable from their sides. Just unconditional. So where does that unconditional thing come from? It comes from one's relationship with Krishna. So that goes back to the other side. One's own relationship with Krishna needs to be strengthened and purified so that one can extend like that. And then be instrumental, just like how Prabhupada was instrumental with Shyamasundara. How did that bind Shyamasundara to Prabhupada? It took him right out of whatever that mode of nature was that was the impetus for drug dealing to begin with, just by contact with Prabhupada, the loving nature of Prabhupada. He was describing, this was at Vyasa Puja time, just after Janmashtami. He had come to Chicago to get his liver transplant and saw that as another complete amazement. He said, just Prabhupada's magic. Even today, just very quickly, he found by some medical checkup that he had a tumor in his liver, and the doctors all told him he had to have a liver transplant. And he went to another, and liver transplant, liver transplant, liver transplant. And then another doctor said, well, wait a minute, maybe we can do some procedure. Maybe we can, like, reduce the size of the tumor. And they went inside, and they saw the size of the tumor and sewed him back up right away and said, you need a liver transplant. And then somebody else said, well, maybe we can do some radiation. So they opened him up again, radiation, nothing happened, sewed him back up. No change. You got to have liver transplant. And, you know, to get liver transplants, it normally takes to find a cadaver where they have an organ donor that matches your blood type and everything else, so it'll take properly 6 to 9 months. And you probably don't have that much time left to live. So then you need a live person organ donor. But, you know, generally that doesn't happen because who's going to give their liver to another person? But anyway, that's what we recommend. And so a message went out through our, you know, chakra and other types of dandavats and other things. Within 48 hours, the hospital had received 60 volunteer persons from around the world that were ready, without even knowing Shyamasundara, to donate their liver. And the hospital came to him and said, who are you? This never happens. Even you're like Mr. Big Guy. Never happens, because it's maybe a relative. But, you know, it never happens. Who are you? He said, I'm Krishna's devotee. And all these people are Krishna's devotees, and it's just Prabhupada's magic. It's just Prabhupada's showing me one more time his love for me. That's how, you know, that's his, because what connection does he have with Krishna other than Prabhupada? He said that Shyamasundara is about 6'3", and Prabhupada was, you know, 5 foot something. So whenever I would stand with Prabhupada, Now I look at pictures and movies and, you know, video things. I see how short Prabhupada was, but I can tell you, when I was with Prabhupada, I always felt I was looking up to him. Because that was his heart. He was, although stature was like, you know, parent and child kind of difference, foot and a half difference. So that helps take someone out of their condition, is a struggling condition. There's a very strong, loving relationship where the person on the side of giving love is just unconditionally. It doesn't, you know. How to deal with it. Something else. Yeah.
Hi. Maharaj, I was just wondering when Brahma was, when the spiritual world is illuminated by the effulgence of Lord's body, Brahma Jyoti, so when Brahma came up, like he couldn't see everything, was in darkness?
Because it was inside the shell of the universe. The universe has a shell, like a coconut. There's a shell of the coconut, and inside the coconut is the hollow part. And that's where Brahma was, inside the hollow part. The term is Brahmanda. It's the hollow portion in which all the planets are situated. So that's why it was darkness. Although outside the shell of the universe is the Brahma Jyoti. Okay? That address your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
For clarification, this, when Lord created this universe, he was saying, or the understanding what I have is to satisfy the desires of living entities, one who wants to be independent. Thus, is he aware at the time of creation, or he's going to create that living entities are going to rip at him at some point?
Well, you know, the frame of the question is time-bound. And that's misleading. Because it's not time-bound. How old are the living entities? They're eternal. So the frame of the question is, when the Lord creates living entities, is he aware that... But it's like, once upon a time, there weren't living entities. And then it was living entities time. And then, boop, there's living entities. And did the Lord know that they'd have this problem later on? At least some of them. Where there's free will, there's proper use or misuse. Option. A or B. Always. Eternally. So, the answer is yes. But not in the frame that you presented. Prabhupada's example is when a state forms a government, they're aware that there will be people who rebel from the laws of the state. So they create a prison house. And the prison house is meant for those that refuse to acknowledge the laws of the state. So they're not put out of existence, they're put in the prison. That's the material world. It's a prison house for rebellious people that don't want to live peacefully. They're given a place to stay in a prison.
Does the Virat Rupa serve as master blueprint for all?
Yes.
And
yes. It's described each day of Brahma. He wakes up in the morning and he takes the impression from Virat Rupa, where he receives, okay, here's the plan for the day. And he does it. So that's another, it's like the prototype, the subtle form of the universe before that form of the universe which we can perceive with our senses is manifest by Brahma.
Operating principles, everything in the warehouse of immediate.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, it's everything manifests from the Lord, whether it is good or bad, right? So when there is no.
Well, just the term good or bad is relative, isn't it? So I have to interrupt. Well, I don't have to interrupt, but I interrupted because from Krishna's perspective, everything that comes is good. It's how we use it may not be good. Because as soon as you say everything that exists comes from the Lord, including bad and good, so it's like in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the opulences of the Absolute, there's negative things that say there. Everything comes from me. This first set of verses, fame and infamy. Or later on, I'm the cheater of the cheats. I'm the ability in man, including the cheaters, including the thieves, including the terrorists, including Hiranyakashipu. So, how Hiranyakashipu uses what the Lord gives him, that's up to Hiranyakashipu. He can use it in a good way or a bad way. The whole question of ethics, you know, bad comes from God. Make God bad. So we have this, if you say everything is, if you have, the sense of, I'll keep it simple. Our philosophy is achintya bheda bheda tattva. That everything is simultaneously one with and different from the Supreme. If it's everything is one with the Supreme, then you have this problem that bad comes from the all good. But you do it the other way and say things are just independent. And what exists independent from the Supreme? What exists without its connection with the Supreme? It's oneness with the Supreme. You've got another problem, you know, philosophically or theologically. So, oneness and difference. A living entity has free will, and with that free will they can properly or improperly use it. Any improper use is bad, or ethically wrong, or not to be done, or evil. It's the use of the thing, it's not the thing. Like a knife. Is it bad or good? Depends on how it's used. Free will, is it bad or good? Depends on how it's used. Anything you think of, it depends on how it's used. And the Lord is giving his instruction. Use it this way. We say no. We don't even bother saying no, we just use it however we like. Which is tacit no. That's under the category of evil. We didn't follow the instructions when we were provided some facility. When you give something to your son and he breaks it, you're bad. You're not bad. You gave something to your son. You told him how to use it. Use it some other way. So was it a mistake to give it to him? And like this question, does the Lord know that we're going to misuse things? Yes. But he's still giving us the opportunity. He's so compassionate. He gives us the opportunity to properly use things. As he's handing us, here's this human form of life. Here's the operator's manual, Bhagavad Gita. He's forever inviting the fallen conditioned souls to associate with him in a loving and serving mood. Knowing that that living entity is, using Bhaktisiddhanta's language, he's forever apt to indulge in the very activity that will bring himself harm. Not wrong on the part of the Lord. He's giving an opportunity. Like Prabhupada, he compassionately invited young people from America to engage in devotional service, to purify and perfect their lives. Did he know that some might take that up and then misuse it? He knew. But he was giving them an opportunity. Us, and you know, some are still with it. Some, but Prabhupada's understanding was whatever little bit that they did with sincerity, that's to their eternal spiritual credit. It was risk-taking. Because it may have, by persons taking it up and then misusing it, give the name of devotional service a bad name. Because people look at the people who misused it. That's a risk. Prabhupada was a risk-taker. Because of his compassion. And what he wanted us to do was understand, once we're in devotional service, we're representing him, and people will judge him and the process of devotional service based on our conduct. So we should come to the right standard. But he did not so strongly emphasize that as much as he gave himself in a loving way, which bound people to him stronger than words of caution. Don't take this process of devotional service and misuse it. It was more just a loving invitation, encouraging us to go back to Godhead and he would assist us. Is that something else? Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
Jai. Srila Prabhupada Swami Maharaj. Jai.